Yo, what's the heavy hitter DJ Wala, and you're now plugged into the Subject Thread Podcast with your host, Nyla Lavelle.
Like, there are certain people that have these ability to be independent contractors, self-employed, day traders, real estate investors, singers, artists, those type of people. Avenues within the real estate umbrella, because there's so many different ways to make money in real estate. I think a lot of people miss that.
Right, right. And that's very true, because when you say real estate, that's the umbrella, right? That's what, and then there's so many other strategies. So real quick, what I'll do for our listeners is explain a little bit about what wholesaling real estate is.
I like that question, because I was just talking about this yesterday, and I feel like with Kanye, he's like, he does things that we all do behind closed doors.
Yeah, I've never been asked that.
This is Subject Thread Podcast. We different here.
You are now tuned in to Subject Thread Podcast, giving you real dose of storyboard conversations, art, money, culture, and more.
Hey, what is up, guys? What is up? We have a very, very special podcast episode for you today. We have Mr. Pastor Walrund in the building from FCBC NYC from Harlem, New York in the building. We're going to talk about entrepreneurship today. We're going to get into some hot topics and just chop it up. How are you, sir?
Pretty good. Glad to be with you today.
Awesome. Do you like the snow outside?
You know, I got in just as it was flurrying, so I didn't see how it progressed. Is it snowing harder now?
Yeah, actually it is. It's like, it's not winter yet, but we already got this going on.
Oh, yeah, it was flurrying when I came in.
But it happens. So we're going to just go ahead and dive in. I want to thank you for coming on Subject Thread Podcast today. It was something that I actually requested from our assistant who works with us. And I want to just dive into a couple of questions with you in terms of entrepreneurship. One thing that I've never seen in a church environment is someone pushing entrepreneurship. And I've seen that with the Hope Initiative. How did that come about?
Oh, the Dream Center?
Yep.
Dream, yeah. Well, really, we launched the Dream Center in 2012.
Okay.
And the idea was back then to create cutting edge programming, all free programming around economic development, leadership, entrepreneurship, and arts and culture. And part of it was that we created those pillars in which entrepreneurship is one because of what the community asks for. At the church, we don't necessarily do programming or even what we would consider back in the days ministries based on just good ideas. We really base it on what we view as the needs of the community, as expressed by many people in the community. Now, the Dream Center initially began as an initiative of the church, but then kind of fell under the umbrella of our FCBC Community Development Corporation. But we have launched several entrepreneurship programs over the past several years. And actually, those have been some of our most attended and frequently asked about programs. And for me, I think one of the things is that many people are trying to think of ways, especially in this particular era, of how to really become business owners themselves, small business owners, create their own source of income through creating businesses. I think this is the best time, especially when so much is driven digitally, to do that. And so we wanted to make sure that we give people the resources and tools to really launch their own business, including that was a program, a mentoring program called Live Program, which really helped people go from the beginning of the ideation of the business all the way through business planning and how to do business cards, how to create your website. I mean, everything. So we've offered several programs over the past 4 years in particular that really geared towards entrepreneurship. But again, to answer it simply, it was based on what we really saw as the needs of the community, as expressed by the community. We always want to make sure that the Dream Center is always relevant. And the way we remain relevant is by constantly engaging the community.
Awesome, awesome. That's very innovative, because I've never, again, seen that in a religious type of environment. Now, does someone have to be a part of your church to attend any of these things?
Oh, absolutely not. You can go to dreamcenterharlem.com and you can see the programs that are currently running. But the Dream Center was created for the community, not just for the church.
Okay,
we also
cool.
have, you asked about the Hope Center. I guess you may ask about that later. That's our mental health facility. But the same thing. We didn't do these, create these spaces just for people who are part of the church. It is for the community at large. And the truth is, more people within the community who do not necessarily have a connection to FCBC are actually the ones who are taking advantage of the programming more.
Really?
Yeah.
Very interesting. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, FCBC has many tentacles and many people who are connected to persons who consider themselves members. But, you know, when you look at the Dream Center, how it kind of markets itself and brands itself, it doesn't necessarily brand itself as an FCBC brand. It is the Dream Center of Harlem. So people have gravitated towards the website, have heard about programming. But again, we've just seen an increase in the numbers of people who don't necessarily engage the church, who just involved. And I think it's because the programming is not only good, it's relevant, but the big word is it's free. Mm-hmm. So if you can go through an 8-week program, mentoring program for free. You can get classes on how to really build your own brand. I mean, for free, all this stuff is free, things that you have to pay in other spaces and places for. So we really cover the cost of the programming, even those persons who may come in as mentors and facilitators. We actually cover that cost through programming funds and donations of people. But we always wanted to make sure we keep that programming free. I mean, you know, free is always a great option.
Now, something that you did say, which is really, really important, the digital space. Now, that has really shown in 2020, just with the pandemic and everything that's going on. How do you think that that's going to take over in the future for like 2021, even if things kind of go back to what we call the new normal?
Yeah, let me speak from the perspective of church. I mean, there are some churches who are still worshiping. Our church is not one of those churches. We could not do that. We have, I mean, last time we checked, I think our membership on the roll was close to 11,000 people. We have multiple services. Our sanctuary seats about 2,000 people. And even here in New York, where the governor said that houses of worship could worship at 50% capacity, that still puts us a little over 1,000. We're not going to have a gathering of 1,000 people in this space.
Okay.
And quite honestly, because of how COVID really hit hard in areas like Harlem and Central Harlem in particular, for me, safety is at the forefront. And, you know, we've been offering everything digitally and we haven't seen a drop off in engagement. And so for us, safety is more important. Then on a personal note, before I go to the other part of your question, a personal note, you know, for me, I have a very rare immunodeficiency disease. And so I think one of the reasons our church did not suffer a lot of losses to COVID as of date, I think we've had in the congregation our size, I think we've only, and I don't say only as though it's not monumental because any loss is serious, but I think we've had about 5 or 6 people who passed away from COVID.
Okay.
Where other congregations smaller congregations have had more people because they were still continuing, many congregations were still continuing worship services. We stopped first Sunday in March before it really became really a pandemic in many ways. And that was because I have this immunodeficiency disease where, you know, it's very, very rare. I was born with no antibodies. So I have to get an infusion of antibodies every 4 weeks, which makes me in some ways susceptible to infections. I have to be very careful.
Gotcha.
But lastly, I think that even when we go back to some semblance of normalcy, this has introduced the world really to not just digital models of conducting business, but I think in the future, there'll be a hybrid, some face-to-face, some virtual, because what we've seen is that we can conduct everything virtually. We can even have worship experiences virtually, not fully the same in terms of in-person community building, but I think in the future, there'll be a hybrid of mixed in-person and digital from now on, because the digital space has really created different opportunities and force us to be innovative and creative in ways we didn't always anticipate.
Okay, awesome, awesome. And actually, that's actually how I've been tuning into your services is through the digital portal and just sending out the links to everybody that I know. Now, not to put you on the spot, but just to ask you this question, there are some places of worship that are continuing to do service. Why do you think they're not paying attention to the severity of what's going on?
Well, it depends. I think that you have the people who are more on the conservative and evangelical conservative end of religion who, as we've seen, are more in line with the current president with regard to how they've had this kind of lackadaisical affair to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So they politicize the pandemic, as you know, and mask wearing now becomes a political statement versus a human necessity. So there's still congregations who somehow feel like the restrictions that are in place or the requirements are in place. One, with regard to gathering, is an infringement on their freedom of religion, which is really not. Restrictions do not say you can't practice religion. They're just minimizing how we gather. We can gather all kinds of ways, but no one is saying you can't practice your religion. Mm-hmm. That's one. So I think it's politicized and some people are not regarding that. Secondly, I think that there are many congregations, I mean, in this country, and no matter what the background, who are just not prepared to move digitally and did not have the resources to move digitally. And it became a hardship for them. And we often, people look at large congregations like ours, and that's not the norm in our communities. In the United States, the average congregation has about a membership of between 100 and 150 members. 100 to 150 member congregation may not be able to provide the kind of resources to enable a congregation to purchase cameras, to set up separate live streaming lines. It becomes a fiscal issue. And then lastly, coinciding with that, I think it has been a financial hardship for some congregations. And so I think some congregations are making the decision, let's gather, let's take safety precautions, but it becomes a financial, decision for those institutions, because quite honestly, many churches have closed during the pandemic and some are still struggling for survival and will close. So I think those are some of the three reasons we see people still continuing to gather during the pandemic.
Okay. Yeah. Just from a personal standpoint, I've had family members and a couple of friends tell me stuff like, well, God is going to protect me. And I would say to them, I definitely believe that, but I think that you need to still have respect for other people and have a mask on. And what do you say to those types of people?
Yeah. Well, you know, I honor everyone's opinion. I believe that God is going to protect you on every level. For example, I think God is going to protect you, but you still need to put on the seatbelt.
You
get in the car, right? I mean, so even though I believe in the protection of God, I also believe in precautions that we can take. God is going to protect you, but if they tell you you need to remove your spleen or your gallbladder, you're not going to say God's going to protect me and ignore the doctors. Mm-hmm. So I think that with God's protection is also human responsibility to ensure your own safety and the well-being of those around you and your family. I think that's what wearing the mask is about. It's about safeguarding those around you, your family, and other people. Because you may feel a certain way, it doesn't mean everyone feels a certain way.
Gotcha.
And so, I hear people say, oh, God is going to cover us. God's going to protect us. I remember there was a pastor, I can't remember, I think it was in Virginia, who was anti the restrictions, anti wearing a mask, and was preaching how it was a scheme and plan by the Democratic Party to control our lives. And he had a particular Facebook post where he posted this, and a month later he died from COVID.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. And it happened to numerous clergy who actually passed away, who were actually saying the same thing. So again, God can protect you, but in the midst of what we are living this life, there are things we do. As you get older, you need to take your vitamins. If you have high blood pressure, you need to take the medication. It doesn't mean God's not going to protect you. It means that you must also take your mental, emotional, and physical well-being in your own hand as well.
That was very well said. And you said something that is also very innovative in terms of a church as well. And this is where we want to jump into mental health. Mm-hmm. I saw this one time practiced by Kirk Franklin. He was on an interview with the Breakfast Club, maybe over the summertime. So what he said was he prays, but he also goes to therapy. He was one of the first people of color that I saw push that. Why did you start to implement that within your own structure?
Well, we started it in 2012, actually, because, you know, we had at time five full-time pastors. All the pastors are trained, all have gone to seminary or divinity school, and have had training in pastoral care and counseling. And because of the size of the congregation, I just started seeing that some of the issues that people were presenting, that our pastors were confronting, were beyond the scope of training and ability. You know, a lot of times in the faith-based community, pastors in particular have this feeling that because they're the pastor, they are able to deal with everything that comes their way. No, that is not the case. And we found ourselves referring people to places where they can get mental health services. Well, in 2012, I got to a point where I grew weary of just constantly referring people whose conditions and issues were beyond the scope of our abilities. And so we hired in 2012 a part-time therapist on staff who was seeing people. And I talked about it very publicly from the pulpit back then about the need for us. Yes, we trust God, and yes, God is going to protect us, but there's nothing wrong with seeing a therapist, primarily because I had been seeing a therapist and started seeing a therapist about a year after we hired a part-time person because, you know, as I said, I suffer with a very debilitating rare disease that, you know, has taken a toll on me over the course of my life. I mean, multiple hospitalizations, about three times in my life, I've been close to death with sepsis. One time it was a bacteria called MRSA. That's the one that kills most people. And again, the pain, the medications, the treatments, it got to be too much and it was overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And I knew at that moment that I did not have the resources to just kind of lead myself through this. And I went and sought out a therapist and literally saved my life, saved my sanity. Now, it didn't mean I didn't trust God. I didn't believe in God. But like I said, with the early examples, there are other things we can do, other people we can engage to attend to our physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. And I did that. And so I began to talk about it publicly. I talked publicly about my own bouts with depression, battling depression years ago, even while pastoring, serving, teaching. Mm. But what helped me cope was going to a therapist, and I had to make that decision. So as I began, and I felt the reason why I talked about it publicly, where most don't, is because I know of the stigma around mental health in our communities, in particular African-American communities. Mm-hmm. And so I figured the church is an institution that many people in our community still trust. If the pastor talks about it, if the churches start talking about it, as the pastor talks about it, it kind of liberates other people to talk about it. And then you start really pushing people to really pursue their own mental well-being. So as we did this, our therapist started to get swamped as well. We needed to expand that. And I had a vision for opening a space and facility. And so from 2012, we hired the first therapist. By the time we got to November 2016, we cut the ribbon on the Hope Center, Healing on Purpose and Evolving, which offers free mental health treatment and care, plus workshops, plus group counseling and therapy. We partnership with numerous institutions, including Columbia University School of Psychiatry, NYU School of Social Work, Hunter College School of Social Work. We have three staff members, plus interns, plus other psychiatrists who work with us. But everything, again, is free. Why? Because one of the things, the hindrances in many of our communities, especially underserved communities, are the resources. Therapy is not cheap. And so the financial inability becomes a major hindrance. And that's why there we did the same thing. So when you become an innovator. We don't call them clients. We call them innovators because we want to help people create innovative ways to their own healing. When innovators are accepted into the program, you get 10 free therapy sessions. And then after that, there's follow-up and then there are group sessions and other things we provide. But you get 10 free therapy sessions.
That's unheard of.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that becomes critical. So it started from acknowledging our limitations, to me acknowledging my own issues and struggles with depression, to then taking that and opening up a space for people to get free mental health service.
And to be so transparent like that, that's unheard of. But to also overcome some of the things that you're going through in your own personal journey, 2020 has been a trying year for a lot of people. As we enter into 2021, you said something that was really important about mental health. Like in the Black community alone, the suicide rate has gone up tremendously this year.
Absolutely.
How can we start to refocus our minds for 2021 in an optimistic way? What could we give our listeners?
Well, one of the things I did in the beginning of this, I did a series that talked, one sermon was called I Am a Warrior, I Am Resilient. For me, I think when we find ourselves faced with the kind of crisis we're in that really impacts us spiritually and emotionally, I think sometimes even we have to remember our strength. You know, if you have come through life thus far, I remember sharing that if you're alive right now, that means you survived 100% of your worst days already. You've already survived 100% of your worst days. That means that you can still face and faith forward, that you already have demonstrated the capacity to endure much, to sustain much, and continue to move. We may not be thriving the way we want to thrive, but the capacity to endure and survive. I mean, if you be honest, as African-Americans, we have within us survivor's DNA. All of us are here in this country because somebody with our DNA survived some of the most hellish human experiences known to humanity. Somebody survived. Somebody survived the transatlantic, the Middle Passage, the transatlantic slave trade. I mean, think about the brutality, the inhumanity, the sheer baseness of humanity exhibited in that. If we are here today, somebody with DNA like yours survived and endured that. Mm-hmm. If they survived something that was designed to destroy and obliterate their identity and their humanity and their physical presence, we can endure this. We've already demonstrated that. And so as we move into 2021, I know we hope, many hope that this year will be different. But even if it is not as different, if we've made it thus far, we can do that. At the same time, when you remember your strength, remember your capacity to survive and thrive, also make sure you build communities and networks, a tribe around you who can pour into you and also seek the help you can get, because it's not going to be easy. It hasn't been easy. But sometimes, again, we don't like to share what we're going through. We don't like to be transparent with people we love. And I think all that becomes part of the formula that will contribute to our well-being as we transition into the winter and then into the next year.
You said something that was really, really important about networking and different things like that. One thing that I've noticed about your organization is that you push like HBCU, and I know that you attended one in Atlanta, yeah. Right? How important was Morehouse to you in your walk?
Oh, gosh. When I arrived on Morehouse's campus, there was a seismic shift in my life. It's a very long story, but I'll tell you, I'll put it to you like this. I got into Morehouse on kind of, I would guess, like a hookup. One of the people who was a mentor to me, because I was in kind of like an at-risk program. I wasn't definitely not the model student. In fact, wasn't on my job at all. And I was in this program because some other issues I had. And this mentor was a Morehouse graduate and literally convinced me to take the SAT. I hadn't even planned on taking the SAT. I had other things on my mind, like making money and just doing what I was doing. And mm-hmm. he convinced me to take the SAT, and I, you know, actually killed the SAT. And the issue was that I wasn't smart, because when I was in fifth grade, they tried to put me like in seventh and eighth grade. I was always smart. I got to a point where I didn't want to be that kid. I didn't grow up in an environment in a community that affirmed that. And I acted out against that. I rebelled against that. And it took a toll. So by the time I became, going to my senior high school, you know, my grades were just not good. Again, not because I wasn't smart. I just didn't care because of a lot of other issues that were going on in my life at the time. And so literally this mentor wrote a letter of recommendation to Director of Admissions, who was a good friend of his, and said why he thought I was a perfect candidate to experience transformation at Morehouse. Now, I applied to some other schools. I didn't get in. I won't name the other HBCU in Washington, D.C. that I didn't get into, but I got in the Morehouse, and when I got there, my life was changed. I did things I'd never done before. I was never involved in student government, anything like that. Mm-hmm. My freshman year, I ran for freshman class president and won, right? I mean, wow. It was crazy. I mean, I was introduced to part of myself that was always there. I had not journeyed back towards, and Morehouse did that. And you could not help but feel what they call the Morehouse mystique. You could feel the presence of those who had come before you and who were encouraging you to move on. We were brainwashed. You know, people always talk about Morehouse, man. You can tell a Morehouse man, but you can't tell him much. In many ways, you know, that's a hard word, but you understand what I mean. We were convinced that Morehouse men were to be the leaders of the future, that we were supposed to change this world, that King was just an example of our possibility. Martin Luther King, I mean, was an example of our possibility. He was a Morehouse man. And so that I believe that. I embraced that. I embodied it. And it changed my life. Even when in school, I had a child, my wife and I, with my girlfriend then, who was at Spelman, we had a son. And I was determined to persevere. And my junior year, my son stayed on campus with me between my dorm and my wife's dorm at Spelman.
Wow.
And so,
talk about perseverance.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you hear people having children and they can't drop out of school. We stayed in school and raised our child on campus until our senior year, and we moved off. And my son ended up being a graduate of Morehouse. My daughter ended up graduating from Spelman. I mean, and so it has had an impact on my entire family. It changed my life and helped me see the best of who I am. And I will be forever indebted to Morehouse College.
That's an awesome story. Any plans of expansion to Atlanta, having another church down
there? Yeah. Before the pandemic, we were doing a series of pop-up church experiences in places where we had a significant following. Atlanta actually was one of those places. And we had planning meetings around doing a pop-up service before the pandemic happened. We had one pop-up service. The first one we did was actually in LA because we have a large following in Los Angeles. And I said, well, that would be the hardest one for us to pull off. We're on the East Coast, that's the West Coast. And I said, you know, let's just see. So we literally advertised for about 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks that we'd be coming to LA. We found a place to rent. And we did a pop-up on a Saturday afternoon, and almost 400 people showed up. It was amazing. And we had planned on doing one in North Carolina in the Durham area, okay, in Washington, D.C., and in Atlanta. And so we're going to pick back up on that. But once the pandemic hit, that shifted everything. But those are still the plans, to create at least three more iterations of SCBC.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. One thing that I love about the experience at your church, and you can clear up any kind of misconceptions, but mm-hmm. you guys are really all encompassing. I noticed that there are not just Black people that are part of the congregation. There are a little bit of everybody there. How naive is it for a person to think that you can live a life based on not judging people, no matter their religion, walk mm-hmm. of life, monetary status, and sexual orientation? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I say this because part of my language is different. I mean, if you've seen services and you engage, you see that we're kind of not the norm with regard to churches. Even in the work we've done, we started talking about the Dream Center, Hope Center. But for me, I am a Christian. This is a Christian church, but I'm very intentional about the language I use. I make a distinction between Christianity and what I would say following the teachings of the carpenter. Now, Jesus was a carpenter. I say carpenter intentionally because there are people who try to make a link between Christianity and material prosperity. It is always good to remind people that we claim to follow the teachings of a carpenter, a poor, oppressed Jewish carpenter. And I think following the teachings of Jesus, and here's the thing, I taught this class last night, that much of Christian doctrine, if you look at a lot of what has become foundational Christian doctrine, you will realize that a lot of foundational Christian doctrine is not connected to the teaching of Jesus. Pull a little bit from the Old Testament, you pull some from the teachings of Paul, but very little actually is shaped by the teachings of Jesus, which is ironic because Jesus is the centerpiece of the faith. And so when you look in scripture, Jesus says things like, make disciples, not build cathedrals, not try to see how many members you can get. Make disciples, we baptize and teach what I taught. He said, teach what I taught you. And what you find in many of our traditions, we don't teach what Jesus taught. We teach a combination of other ideas, not disconnected from the Bible, but some disconnected. And for me, when you follow the teachings of the carpenter, at the foundation is the ethic of love, the underlying ethos of love, the affirmation of the inherent dignity of all human beings. That language, that idea of the ethic of love is transcendent. That idea, that ethic is not relegated to Christianity or to any one faith tradition. And that means that we have obligation in honoring the dignity of every human being, means that labels and badges of identification can't hinder that love. So no matter who you are, as you alluded to, we have a large LGBTQ community here. We have a significant amount of people who are white, who are here, who are Latino. We have people who are not even Christian. We have people who are Jewish, who are regular attenders. We have people who are Muslim. I've met a few Yoruba priests and priestesses who come here or coming every Sunday, right? Mm. And I remember one, she was a priestess, a Yoruba priestess, and a friend of hers saw her online to get in the church on a particular Sunday.
Wow.
We have a mutual friend. And he said he saw her online. It was taken that she was online to get into this Baptist church. And he said, you know, what are you doing online here? And her response to him was, I go where the light is. I mean, that's a profound statement.
Yeah, that is.
I go where the light is. And so you find people who are Muslim who come, who are Jewish who come, who have other faith traditions, who are Hindu who come. I just spoke this past Saturday for a global unity gathering led by a Hindu guru. I mean, thousands of people I spoke, right? Here's how the invitation came about. A Jewish woman who's a regular attender here has a father who's a Buddhist priest, who then made the introduction to a Hindu guru for a Black Baptist preacher to speak at this Global Unity Conference.
That is very interesting at a dinner table. But I think that that's really, if that's not what the pandemic has taught me, that we're all kind of the human beings. And one Absolutely. Thing that your church does define is the Be Human Initiative, which really resonated with me personally because we're not going to go there today, but I pretty much had gave up on, you know, faith until one day I started watching your sermons and it just changed my perspective.
Wow.
So,
that's a blessing.
Yeah, definitely did. So I was like, I really want to, you know, bring him on because the things that you say, we don't really hear traditionally in a Black church. We hear a lot of division and there's over 400 religions, but one thing that I can effectively say from you guys is that I don't see divisiveness. I never seen that, or belittling or hypocrisy. Like, it doesn't even resonate with your environment.
No, I'll share this with you. A few years ago, man, a clip from a sermon of mine went viral. I mean, I got all kind of hate mail at the church. There were magazines talking about me. I mean, religious magazines, Christian magazines in particular. And they were saying, you know, people were saying I was going to go to hell for my teachings. And I want you to hear, because, you know, the person who wrote the initial article did it like clickbait. The article said that megachurch pastor says it is insanity to believe in Jesus Christ. Now, of course, if you put that as a title of an article, right, and people know of FCBC, and many people around the country know of me, if you put that there, people were reacting to the title. Now, the funny thing is, I remember afterwards seeing that and talking to the writer of the article. I won't let you know how that conversation went. But the actual clip that people posted where this came from, I never said that, right? And this is where you get it. My statement was, I said, to tell someone, well, let me give you the first part. I said, I honor all path to God. That's what I said. I honor whatever your path was that brought you to God, I honor that. Mm-hmm. And then I said, it is insane to tell somebody they're going to go to hell if they don't believe in Jesus. I said, Jesus never said that. Mm-hmm. So when I said that, oh gosh, it was a major uproar. It was a twisting of my words. And I stood by what I said. I even doubled down on it in the sense of, I remember saying, I added up the number of seconds in my life that I had lived to that point. Not years, seconds. I said, I will let no one or take the critique of anyone who reduces my entire life to a 50-second clip that is inaccurately interpreted, period. I said, that's not going to happen. But it just shows you, when you say that you honor people's path to God, I didn't understand was offensive. And then when you say it's insane to tell someone they're going to hell because they don't believe in Jesus, I think that is insane. Now, why is that? Because if you look at the scriptures, there were numerous people that Jesus taught, that Jesus healed, that were beneficiaries of his power, who he did not say, follow me. He did not say, convert to Judaism. He did it because it was the overflow of his power and his love for humanity. The problem, as I said earlier, we don't always honor the teachings of Jesus. We're more committed to the institution of Christianity than the teachings of the one who's the center of Christianity.
Yeah, I can see where it's controversial. And I can see where you get into a lot of different debates. How do you handle that?
Yeah, what you discover a lot, I get into debates. One of the things that makes it, and here's the thing, the people who are writing articles and all these different essays that are being written, no one ever reached out to me.
Oh,
no
wow.
No one called me. No one talked to me. They just wrote these articles about me from major publications. I was like, this is deep. Like, no one literally reached out to me and said, you know, explain these ideas or talk more about what you believe. But again, it was juicy. It was sensationalized. And somebody needed to put some articles out. And they did that. I've never been hesitant at getting into the conversation or debate. And what I realize is that what happens is when I teach, I do not say, well, this is what Michael thinks should be done. What I teach is I go to the scriptures themselves. Mm-hmm. And I go particularly to the teachings of Jesus and the life of Jesus as it is outlined. And what you will discover, and this is tragic in and of itself, the Barna Institute did a research several years ago and asked people who claim to be Christian what their favorite scripture was. And this is legitimate research that was done, a survey. And the one that got the overwhelming support was this line. If you take one step, God will take two.
Mm.
Now, here's an interesting thing. That's not in the Bible.
Oh, it's not?
No, it's not in the Bible.
Yeah.
Nowhere. So what was interesting is that what was considered the scripture was not even scripture. It was a saying. And then if you ask other Christians some of their favorite scriptures, the average Christian will quote something in the Old Testament, maybe a psalm, or the average Christian will quote something in the writings of the Apostle Paul. But very few Christians say that some of their favorite verses come from the teachings of Jesus. Most, believe it or not, most Christians are not as steeped in the teachings of Jesus. Now, what they believe Jesus does, he died for my sins, he's the way to salvation, that's doctrine. They believe that. But the literal teachings of Jesus, you find that most Christians don't really quote Jesus. They quote Paul more than they quote Jesus.
That's very interesting. That's very, very interesting. It's something that I now I want to do research on that. But I actually got a scripture that resonates for me from a Muslim. His name is Nuri Muhammad, and he was quoting something from John 10:16, and it said something like, "I have other sheep which are not of this fold." So So when that resonated to me, because I was like, well, that must be everybody or just different people, not what you traditionally think. Am I interpreting that wrong?
No, you're not. I mean, it's not just in the New Testament. It's also in the Old Testament. When the prophet Baal, when the king asked, rather, the king asked the prophet to bless his people only. And the prophet went to talk to God. And God said that I have children you know not of. Right. So the same thing in John. I have sheep that you do not know of. And he's echoing what it said. Jesus echoing in John what God says to the prophet in the Old Testament. We don't understand scripture. We don't know scripture enough. So if God is saying, I have children you don't know of, and then Jesus said, there's sheep that you do not know of this fold, why do then we behave arrogantly as though we know who are all of God's children and all of Jesus' sheep? I think it's a bad thing to do. It furthers the division, the divisiveness that exists in religion. Religion ought not be a point of division, although tragically it is. It ought to be a point where we begin to see our commonality as human beings. And the diversity and richness of God's creativity. We miss that opportunity because we're busy trying to make ourselves better than other people.
That is accurate. Now, what person would you say has resonated with you personally, dead or alive, that is someone that we would all know?
That you would all know? Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God. Like a public figure. They can be dead or alive. There's somebody that really resonates with you, their teachings, or just as a person.
So this is not a religious, I mean, I would think of a religious figure as someone who the average person would not know, and that's who has been served as a spiritual mentor to me, although I never met him. He passed away before I even entered ministry, and that was Howard Thurman.
Okay.
He's become more popular now in this moment. It's amazing because he was criticized, he was a Christian, and criticized for being too inclusive and too open in people's faith. And he wrote one of the most paramount books about Jesus. It's a book entitled Jesus and the Disinherited. Powerful book. But he's written many books, The Inward Journey, The Luminous Darkness. I mean, he was always viewed as a mystic in his day and even beyond his death. So he really has been at the forefront of how I've understood the Jesus movement and how I understand Christianity. He's had the greatest impact. Now, interestingly enough, two figures who will go hand in hand for me are actually Miles Davis and John Coltrane.
Oh, my.
I'm a big jazz head, and the improvisational nature of Miles's creativity, and both he and Coltrane, but Coltrane towards the latter part of his life is clearly on a spiritual quest. Mm-hmm. He is seeking numerous ways to make manifest what he believes is divine and the gifts that the divine have given him. And so where his music tastes is changed, that some people could not get towards the end of his life, I saw it as a seeker seeking new ways to express dynamic moves and the dynamism of God in his life. And he almost says that. And so the improvisational nature of Miles is playing this kind of elongated tonal quality. And then John Coltrane viewing him through the lens of a seeker for deeper spiritual expression in his music. Amazing, amazing to me.
Absolutely. And actually, A Love Supreme was a testament of that. That whole
Absolutely.
Thing, he like locked himself away for like months at a time and then came back with a masterpiece. And
I'm going to blow your mind. It was 2 weeks.
Oh, it was 2 weeks?
He stayed in the room above his garage for 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks, he came out with A Love Supreme.
Wow. See, I read somewhere where it was like 6 weeks. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Now, back to songs. What is a song that resonates with you that kind of like changes your life? Every time you hear it, it just takes you to a place.
Oh, gosh. Well, since we're talking about Coltrane, one of the songs I play of Coltrane is Resolution Part 2. I mean, when you listen to Resolution, the beginning with the heavy, it sounds like incoherent bass playing at the beginning. And then all of a sudden, the song drops in, almost it catches you off guard. I look at that as a way, it's that bass line, the beginning intro, is like this kind of searching. I think all my life I've been searching for deeper ways to understand, not all my life, but the large part of my life and my work has been searching for deeper ways to understand God and give expression to the divine. So the beginning of Resolution is that searching. And then all of a sudden, when the song drops in very, it seems spontaneous, it comes very abruptly, boom. And what it is, it's like that discovery. I've searched and I've found, and now I'm going to walk on this path that has been open to me now. But that searching starts over again. And that discovery, the searching and discovery of resolution is shapes my life. Search, discovery, search, discovery, search, discovery.
Awesome, awesome. So what are your plans for 2021? And just as in an entire scope. I know it's a lot.
Yeah, it's big. I think continuing to create a space through this work at the church, it allows people to have a creative encounter with God, a transcendent and transformative encounter with God. I think for me personally, I'm continuing to lean into the evolution of my own spirituality that has grown tremendously over the past 2 years in particular, with really incorporating certain Buddhist and even Hindu practices in my spirituality. It doesn't shake who I am as a Christian and a follower of the teachings of Jesus, but it just expanded how I think through, especially with regard to meditation. And so to continue that journey, continue that walk, it's a very foundational thing. I'm going to continue to be an amazing, I say amazing, husband to my wife of 27 years and my two children. And honestly, if I had to wrap it up, if you've seen FCBC, you know there are three words that galvanize us in our movement. I'm going to continue to live, love, and serve.
Now, how does someone find you guys if they're just new to you?
FCBCNYC.org, FCBCNYC.org, or you can find me on social media, or particularly Twitter and Instagram. You can find the same thing, FCBCNYC on Instagram. And you can find myself on those outlets at Mike Walron, MikeWalrond, at Mike Walron. So yeah, that's how you can find it.
Thorough. Well, we definitely thank you for coming on Subject Thread Podcast. And I thank you for being an inspiration just to my life as well.
Oh my God.
I definitely appreciate you for coming on today.
Well, thank you for having me. And it's truly been my pleasure and an honor to be here and share with you. And I hope you continue to live the life you were created to live.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
We are out, guys. Thank you for tuning in.